The Sandokai isn't in verse form, so I remembered that I brought along these. It's the same translation, so maybe it won't be that helpful, but it has it broken into verse form, so you can see how the couplets work. I think it's helpful to look at it that way. So continuing where we left off, Mike brought up these lines, but we didn't get to go too far into them. The last lines of grasping things is surely delusion, according with sameness is still not enlightenment. And at this point, I think I feel somewhat obliged to bring up a little bit about the Huayan school, because this seems to be a very strong influence on Shirto here. He's using terms that are kind of originate with this Huayan school of Buddhism, which was beginning just maybe 100 years before Shirto lived. Huayan means flower adornment, Japanese kegon, in Sanskrit avatamsaka. So it's a school of Buddhist thought based on the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Huayan Sutra, which some of you may know, this huge 1,000-page sutra that is full of wild cosmic descriptions of the universe, and particularly emphasizing the interpenetration of everything. The famous metaphor of Indra's jeweled net comes from this sutra and this Huayan school. The jewel net of Indra is this great image, right, where there's a net, an infinitely vast extending net of jewels, like picturing like a shining jewel on each place where the strings of a net cross. And each jewel reflects all the other jewels. And not only that, but they reflect all the other jewels that are reflected in all the other jewels. So, infinite reflection, everything included in everything else. Everything's reflected in everything else. And it's all one net at the same time. Apparently one of these Huayan founders built, to kind of demonstrate this, built this hall made out of mirrors, and where everything's reflecting everything else. And someone a Zen student in modern times in America built one of these mirror houses. And I can't remember who or what Zen tradition they're connected with, but you can see this on YouTube. You can see them, there's a little video of them building the house, and then a little bit of, it's like I think there's a Buddha in the center, like a kind of a maybe glass Buddha that you can see through it, and a candle, and then they close the doors. And so it's like this lit up Buddha is like reflected in this ceiling and the floor and, you know, everything. So that's a little different from earlier teachings about form and emptiness. In a way, it's a derivation of it. But particularly, it's about dependent co-arising, the interdependence of everything. And nothing existing independently, everything reflecting everything else. And another main teaching of this Huayan school is these two terms, principle and phenomena, which are used in the Sandokai several times. So it's what makes it seem like it's really, Shirto is looking at some of this Huayan teaching. Principle and phenomena. Phenomena and principle. Phenomena mean is ji in Japanese. It means like things or phenomena. It's the side of multiplicity. And then principle is like principle or truth. Ri in Japanese is pretty much equated with emptiness. But we could also say like all-inclusiveness, oneness, the side of unity. So in the earlier, like the Heart Sutra, we have form and emptiness. There's always these two sides. As soon as you set up two different aspects of reality, you can have interesting conversations. You have this very dynamic thing, the relationship between form and emptiness, difference and unity, phenomena and principle. So these two lines he brings up for the first time, and you can see it in the Chinese lines, especially because it's, you know, grasping things is this term. Things is this phenomena, grasping things, and the next line is according with. Here it says, this one says sameness, maybe the other says principle, but that's the character for principle, so they're set up like that. And then each of them has their problem, right? Grasping phenomena is surely or basically delusion, so it kind of ends with delusion, and according with principle is still not enlightenment. So they actually, the lines end with delusion and enlightenment like that too. So, and in a way, that's like a summary of the whole practice, really. Especially grasping things is basically delusion. That's, our practice is based on this, right? Grasping phenomena, things. And grasping means grasping as real, as independently existing, mentally holding to, believing even, you know, grasping, we could say believing in things is basically delusion, believing in, you know, phenomena being the way that we think they are is basically delusion, and that's the world we live in, basic delusion, pretty much 24/7, as they say, is like, you know, I couldn't even pick up this cup if I didn't actually think it was a cup. So there's some just really basic delusion going on here. Now, I may be able to just, you know, go along with this conventional world and say, well, it appears to be a cup, and, you know, my mind is conditioned very strongly to see it that way, and we may still be able to use things like cups without, you know, deeply believing that it really is a cup. But and that's practice we can open to by understanding through these teachings and through Zazen and so on, that it's not really a cup, and that's like the principle. So it when it seems to be a phenomena standing on its own, then we almost can't help but grasp it in a way that just believing that it is a phenomena is a kind of grasping, actually. Very, very subtle and continuous kind of grasping and delusion. and then opening to this principle. And sometimes this is in Zazen, by like loosening up our conceptuality by just sitting again and again, watching our thoughts not be able to get a hold of anything really, watching how they just come and go again and again. They might not disappear, but there's some, they start to loosen up around phenomena. So we can still do things, but maybe we don't have to take quite so seriously that this really is a cup. And like, please don't argue with me, tell me it's not, or I'll get very upset. You know. And still, sometimes we can get even more into phenomena, in like sesshin. Sometimes we can get, isn't it true?
The way it's done.
Yeah, yeah. So just talking to Kathy, like, by the way, the clackers at the end of the meal, it's like, you know, the chant comes before the roll down, right? So like, this is like phenomena, get really into phenomena, because we're just really aware of all these things, right? And I think this is good. This is part of the challenge and joy of sesshin, is that we have all these particular ways of doing things that are totally annoying. But if we didn't, if we just said, okay, here's this room, just go in, and there's no schedule, there's no particular forms, you just go and do whatever you want in there, enjoy the week, it would have a really different feeling. We would, maybe we'd fall into this other side of according with sameness. We'd just be like, it's all the same. But this is a problem too, is falling into like that the phenomena doesn't matter. So I think it's always this integration. Zen practice is beautifully designed to have these two sides of like very particular details, phenomena, world, and in this larger context of nothing's actually happening and there's nowhere to go and nothing to do and like, what's all this fuss about? Another image for the way these two sides work together. It's like the group, this is a kind of Ji and Ri thing. You'd say the group of us together, this is like sesshin, and we're like this one body. And I think the more, as the days go on, I find it feels more like that, especially when we're sitting all totally still. We don't know what's going on in everyone's mind, but like, it feels like this very unified body of practice. It's very beautiful, right? Sitting together in silence. We're one thing, and yet we're all these individual people at the same time. And society is like this too. The larger society of the world is a good example for how each individual person actually makes up the society, or each of us makes up the sesshin. There's not like some abstract sesshin apart from the people in it. Like there's a sesshin happening and then each of us can go participate in it. It's not really that way. It's more like we come together and that's when the sesshin starts. That's, we make it. Each individual makes it. If one individual was missing, it would be a slightly different sesshin. And so each of us affects the whole, and in the larger society of the world it's like this too. And yet the whole affects the individual. So the way the whole sesshin flows along, and the mood of sesshin or something that we co-create, then affects each individual person. And society definitely like this, right? We individual people make laws and so forth, and then those laws affect everybody in the society individually. So back and forth, there's a whole and one unit, and then there's multiplicity. So grasping these individual phenomena particularly as real, as independent only, is surely delusion. According with principle is still not enlightenment. And so our little six ancestor reference about not, according with principle not being enlightenment. So he's commenting here on Maha Prajna Paramita, and he's saying, what is Maha? Maha is great. The capacity of the mind is broad and huge like the vast sky. Do not sit with the mind fixed on emptiness. If you do, you will fall into a neutral kind of emptiness. Emptiness, we could also say principle, includes the sun, moon, stars, and planets, the great earth, mountains and rivers, all trees and grasses, bad and good people, bad and good things, heaven and hell. They are all in the midst of emptiness, or principle. The emptiness of human nature is also like this. So, pointing out, emptiness is not some abstract, nihilistic nothingness. That would be one way to read this line. Well, we don't want to grasp all these individual phenomena, the G, so let's just sit in this vast re where there's no thing. But actually, emptiness includes sun, moon, stars, planets, earth, grass, all of this. So the re contains the G. And continuing, all the objects of the senses interact and yet do not. So I think Suzuki Roshi's commentary says all the objects, this one says all the objects of the senses. I think really it's the senses and their objects. It's the sense gates and all objects is literally what it says. So and he says, that's just a way of saying everything. The whole phenomenal world, actually. It's a kind of specially Buddhist way of talking about the world of experience in terms of like Abhidharma, like Buddhist psychology. We say the whole world is just these six sense gates and these six sense objects, meaning eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. We include the mental sense and color, sound, smell, taste, touchables, and mental objects, dharmas. Everything is included. There's nothing outside of the six objects and six sense gates, which is, just a basic Abhidharma kind of teaching, and Buddha's early teaching also. But it's actually a pretty radical statement to say that the whole world is just these 12 things. Everything we can think of, or maybe more accurately, everything we can ever experience is just one of these 12. Our experience is it's just a bunch of sensory data. And particularly, a lot of it falls into the last one of mental phenomena, like all our ideas and thoughts and mental constructions are all that last category of mental objects. So all the sense gates and the objects interact. When they meet, we have experience. And do not interact. Interact, and yet do not. Interact, literally, the interact is like turning and influencing each other. They're completely interdependent. And yet, they're not. And I think this could be interpreted in ways that maybe are a little off, especially as these verses keep going. But in the phenomenal world, there's this interdependence of eyes and colors and tongues and tastes and so on. But that's actually the phenomenal world, the world of ji, and the world of ri, principle. Actually, there's no interaction. In the world of emptiness, there's actually the senses and their objects don't interact. Nothing's happening at all. In the world of principle or emptiness, there's no things. There, even as much as these very basic building blocks of organs and objects, colors and so on, as the Heart Sutra says, right? There's actually no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. There it is, right? That's the... it goes through the same list and says there isn't any. So that's the world of ri. And this, in the Huayan system, I just briefly bring this up because Suzuki Roshi's commentary, for people who've been looking at that, he mentions one of these categories of Huayan, but he doesn't really explain it. So there, it's like there's four, they call Dharma Dhatus, but it's like four ways of looking at the universe, let's say. And one is principle. The way, you know, the Dharma Dhatu, or the whole universe, seen as just one unity without anything in it. Then there's the universe as seen through the, you could say, like the lens of phenomena. So it's, we have the ri universe, we have the ji universe, and then we have ri and ji non-obstructed, interacting non-obstructed. So ri, ji, muge, phenomena, or we could say like form and emptiness, don't obstruct each other. Literally don't obstruct each other, but like they mutually interpenetrate, like in this jewel net, in this unobstructed way. And then the fourth of these universes is phenomena and phenomena non-obstructing each other. And that's the one Suzuki Roshi mentions, Jiji Muge. So literally means like, now we just like leave out the whole idea of principle. We just say phenomena and phenomena don't obstruct each other. And that's the kind of culmination, interestingly, I think, the culmination of this YM relationships of principle and phenomena is like, you'd think it would culminate in principle, right? In like emptiness, but actually it culminates in the non-obstruction of phenomena and phenomena. Which is another way, because of that, we can say, according with principle is still not enlightenment. The final, most complete workings of the universe is just when phenomena are completely interactive without obstructing each other. All the objects of the senses interact and yet do not. So the world of phenomena, there's all this interaction. And and the world of principle, there's no interaction. Interacting brings involvement, otherwise each keeps its place. Now, I think this is a little problem here, actually. I think that the word other, in my translation here, the word otherwise, I don't think is quite right. I think it was a problem I heard, well, what is this about? It's a kind of a nice idea that, like, well, there could be an eye and a color, and they interact. But then when they're not interacting, they're just sitting there, a color and an eye. I think that might be an easy way to look at it, but I don't think it's quite right. According to particularly, you know, different schools of Buddhism look at this a little differently. And so from the point of view of the Yogacara or mind-only school, this is just I'm most familiar with, and I resonate most with this. So it's not the only point of view here, but from the point of view of Yogacara, there aren't colors resting in their own place apart from eyes seeing them. They simultaneously arise. You could say, well, this sounds like a little strange technical point, but actually to really contemplate this is a very radical thing that I think can inform our practice in the sense that everything arises with us. In terms of experience, that's why it's called the mind-only school, because there's nothing outside but we can't talk about or know anything outside of our particular experience. We only have our experience to go on. So in terms of our experience, we open our eyes and there's a color, a sight, and from this teaching, it's that they simultaneously arise interdependently. So if you don't have an eye, then you don't have colors, actually. And if you don't have colors, you don't have an eye. And doesn't this make sense if we look deeply at it? It's actually, I think, quite, in terms of our experience, it's almost like common sense. But we actually, outside of our experience, maybe common sense, but based just on ideas outside our experience, we think that, you know, like before we walk into the room, that there's a room here. We just, and a lot of things seem to support that, like, because it seems to look almost the same every time we come in. So it's very convincing that, well, we can walk out the door and be about to leave and then quickly turn back and look. Like, well, we could say, well, the room's really quick, you know. It disappears, and then as soon as we turn back, just in time, it appeared again. But actually, I think it is kind of like that. It's like it's not that there's nothing here, but there's not a zendo or a room, and there's not even if we break it down to like a beige color of goes on that. It doesn't come in colors without an eye organ to perceive it. I think modern science and, you know, brain science and psychology and would agree with this too. It's, for example, like colors. You know, I've talked about this at Santa Cruz too many times, I think. I think I've even talked about it at Jikoji before. That, you know, colors are just wavelengths in the air, and that are perceived by an eye. You know, there's just science talks about this. This Roy G. Biv, right? There's this like narrow wavelength that humans perceive as colors, and other animals maybe have slightly different wavelengths, but that in itself shows that they're not actually like colors without someone to perceive them. We're not saying that there's no waves in the air, but in a way, waves is a human construct too. This is like science is actually human constructs also. So we're not saying that there's nothing, but we're saying as soon as we label it as anything, where it's in the realm of created by mind. So is there a world outside of mind? If there is, I think we can't call it a world, because world is a mind construction of humans. So, so that's partly why I would say that we say interacting brings involvement, otherwise each keeps its place. I don't think it's that when the eye and the colors come together, then there's this interaction. But when they don't come together, they just rest. There's an eye resting over here and a color there. At least from the Yogacara point of view, that wouldn't be true. But yes,
from that school, there's a great emphasis placed on something called the storehouse consciousness, where the thoroughly established is absent an eyeball. All you're left with is the potential and the possibility.
Yeah, I think if we call it a potential, yeah, there's karmic tendencies stored in the storehouse consciousness. You know, this is, again, a model, a human-constructed model, the Alaya Vijnana. But in that model, there's karmic dispositions, particularly for humans, to see colors. So there's this potential all set up there. And so particularly, you know, we actually need, in order to experience and know we have an experience of beige, we actually need a little bit more than just an eye and a color. We also need a conceptual consciousness.
A beige generator,
yeah. We need a predisposition for beige, which means we've seen a color chart and we've labeled all these different colors, and one of them is called beige. And and even if we're talking about animals that don't have language, still they have dispositions for a certain colors they relate to, even if they don't have words to put on them.
Different. Well, how do you maintain that? Do you have to keep thinking about the blue sky to remember the blue? And it's really interesting to have these conversations.
So maybe over many years, if someone had never seen blue, they would start to forget. They have no reference for it.
That's amazing. It's really interesting.
It would be a smell, a
taste. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or it would start morphing into red in their mind, maybe, and, you know, and then if they saw it, then suddenly their sight vision came back, and everything would be reversed, maybe.
Yeah, I was like, well, do you keep thinking about that blue sky, so you remember that blue sky? You know, it's just...
Memory...
We all have different ways of doing it and thinking of it.
Yeah, so this storehouse consciousness with all its dispositions... I think it's amazing that how much it's like the container of memory too. So it seems to be very good at its job. I mean, even people with Alzheimer's or something, it's like it's still remembering a lot of basic information like colors and stuff.
It's still all there.
Yeah, it's all there. I mean,
it's all there.
Yeah.
Keep it, you know, where you can pull it out.
Yeah, we say we only access this tiny like tip of the iceberg of like our. Well, we could say our storehouse consciousness, like which Yogacara says every experience we've ever had, the tiniest one, is like registered in this storehouse. So
even stuff like passions, it's like you're abandoning the storehouse consciousness that we have. And they feel that they're traitors. And the others are saying, well, you just want to live in your own special world. You know, so there's more than just ideas and things. It's like enormous passions.
And how we all affect each other, like this is the society of deaf people constructed by the individual deaf people, or blind or whatever, yeah.
Because what you call blue and what I call you know, your perception of it, I may see what in your eyes, mind would be brown.
Yeah.
If we both agree to call it blue,
then
we'd never even... know it.
Yeah.
But we think our tendency is to say, well, if we're calling it blue, it's the same
thing. Yeah. And we seem to agree on so many things that we think our experience must be pretty similar. And sometimes I've had that fantasy, like, well, what would it be like to, like, just for a minute, completely enter somebody else's mind? We have just thought of that movie, Being John Malkovich. It's kind of like that, but then, you know, but they don't get totally into all the nuances of it. You know, if it was really like that, I sometimes think like, it's probably pretty similar. We just, suddenly the colors would shift like a little bit because we perceived a little differently. But our storehouse consciousness, you shift that whole thing. But sometimes I think, actually what seems to be a person who's almost the same, we would just immediately just die of shock. Sometimes I think it would be like the way like all the neural pathways work and everything would be so different, we'd just be like, freak out. I don't know. Maybe science will discover a way to do this sometime. Even if it did.
I think about a friend of mine that I sail with, and he's colorblind. Mm. And it's really interesting because his eyes worn like these, you know, faded clothes, you know, to race him. And like 2 years ago, he shows up on the boat and he's got like this bright pink shirt on, this bright orange shirt on. I'm like, wow. You know, it was just like, and you know, I think to myself, does he really realize how bright this is? You know, and
and how the contrast between them is
a
little clashing, maybe. Yeah, yeah. Hmm. Yeah. And I think as we sit in Sesshin more, we start to see more and more how the mind is constructing our world, right? We can have a period of zazen that's like hell. We might like, I don't think I can, you know, if I had a gun right now, I would end it all. And then the next period, oh my God, it's never been the greatest zazen ever, you know? And exactly the same conditions, you know? So just mind creates heaven and hell. I think it becomes more and more apparent, like, how intense it can get when we're just, like, hanging out in our own mind in a silent week like this. So another translation of this part, related yet working differently, though each keeps its place. That, I think, is fine. That doesn't say, otherwise each remain, you know, when they're not interacting, they remain in their own place. The otherwise was the problem. Otherwise each remains in its place. Because I think the point is that it's at the same time. Each, let's see, related yet working differently, though each keeps its place. So I think the point is, yeah, simultaneously, there's an eye seeing a color interacting in this phenomenal world, and at the same time, the eye is just the eye and the color is just the color. So otherwise, each remains in its own place, sounds like, when they don't interact. So I think it's, this one sounds like, at the same time of interacting, they're related yet working differently, though, I would put in parentheses, at the same time, each keeps its place. Or another one is, interacting, they permeate one another, yet each remains in its own place. To me, those two are better than otherwise, each remains in its own place. And this is part of the Swayam thing. I think it's coming from like the jewel net of Indra. There's all these infinite reflections of jewels, and yet there's each individual particular jewel. And each keeps its place is this you know, abiding in its position. So I think of Dogen Zenji in the Genjo Koan, and now, just by getting into this, I think maybe he was playing with some of this Huayan stuff a little bit. And when he's talking about firewood and ash, I think many people know the Genjo Koan. There's a section where Dogen says, firewood becomes ash, and it does not become firewood again. Yet do not suppose that the ash is future and the firewood past. Firewood abides in the phenomenal expression of firewood, which fully includes past and future and is independent of past and future. Ash abides in the phenomenal expression of ash, which fully includes future and past and is independent of future and past. this phenomenal expression, ho-yi, can also be translated dharma position. And it's the same character here. Each abides in its own position. I think it's very similar to what Dogen's saying. Here it's these eye and color are interacting, yet each are at the same time abiding in their own position. And Dogen's talking about like time in this case, like firewood seeming to turn into ash, yet firewood is just, it's not turning into anything. At the same time, it seems to be turning into something and disappearing. In that moment, in any given moment, it's just abiding in its position, the same E position, its dharma position. And we, Dogen says, like, we don't call winter the beginning of spring nor summer the end of spring, and birth and death similarly. Each things would seem to be turning into other things. It's not actually like things change into other things. It's just that there's something completely expressing itself in its dharma position in one moment, and then it ceases. And then another one's born.
I was the other wake up.
And even then, it's not even that there's one person, say, or one experience changing gradually from negative to positive through neutral. It's more like there's this completely negative abiding in its phenomenal expression of negative in its dharma position. And then that's like, it only, its dharma position only lasts for one tiny, tiny moment. And then it ceases, and then there's a new one, completely fresh in its own dharma position, that's completely interrelated and completely conditioned by the previous one. But this would be like impermanence is, you know, in Buddha's teaching is a little bit different than things changing into other things. It's more like radical impermanence is like moment. There's one moment that ceases, and then there's a new moment that's dependent on the previous one ceasing.
And also free.
And free of it, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, what is it?
That's Dogen.
Dogen says it's includes past and future and is independent of past and future. Yeah. Yeah, completely free from, and yet. Yeah. Otherwise, we'd be totally stuck.
Right?
Yeah.
Changing from black to white, there's a term for that.
And all that stuff, that's all those dispositions that are stored in this storehouse of mind. If we're not watching them carefully, they'll just do their thing. Like, it starts to get dark, and then there's some dark dispositions start to add on to it. And we have to, like, yeah, it's just mindfulness, paying attention to that. We can catch it sometimes. And like, oh, I'm going down a dark road here. And we don't need to do that, yeah. It's hard to catch it, though. I mean, on a small level, it's really hard to catch, just in a moment-to-moment way, how we're shifting along with, our habits are just so strong. It's amazing.
The patterns.
The patterns, yeah. And yet, the beauty of it too is that they're simply that. They're just patterns. They're phenomenal, interactive G patterns. And at the same time, they interact and yet do not. They ultimately, none of that is really happening from the point of view of principle. There's just the universe as it is, which includes all our karmic patterns and everybody else's and everything.
And we always have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
We can forget that.
Yeah.
No, we can forget that.
Yeah. We have it, but even choice is like has these two sides, right?
Yeah.
Choice has like we can make our choice moment to moment, and then from this bigger point of view, like choice is just another part of this whole thing. Like, and choice is also conditioned. A moment-to-moment free will is actually just arising dependent on conditions. because everything is dependently co-arisen, according to Buddha. Everything is interdependent, and then there's this one little thing on the side called free will or choice that's like can go in there and manipulate the dependent co-arising. It's part of it too. Very tricky. And yet, but that's the beauty of practice and sangha and all that too, is that like because we can't do this ourselves. I think that's the thing, is we can't extract a little part of ourselves and then manipulate our storehouse consciousness. I mean, we can seem to do that, but it's all just part of the storehouse. But then we have these other storehouses where like we have a storehouse machine. We have all these different like ideas and different people, and we're all like influence each other like outside of our own little bubble of my storehouse consciousness. It's amazing. And it even comes through not just people, but through like Dharma words from Sherto in the 8th century, you know, is influencing us. But this is just out of his storehouse consciousness. It got recorded on paper and translated through all these different languages. Yeah, I mean, that's the shift. If there's a moment of no self and other, actually, that sounds like principle. Like there aren't actually phenomena, right? It's like there aren't. It's not like phenomena seem different. It's like there aren't phenomena at that time, right? Phenomena means objects of a subject. That's actually the definition of if phenomena means dharma or ji here too. In order to be a phenomena or a thing, it has to depend on a dualistic setup. It has to depend on some subject. So if there's a moment of complete non-separation of self and other, that's like entering principle. But merging with principle is still not enlightenment. Oh, so hard. Because then, you know, another way to say it is, then we have to come back and talk about, does the end of the meal chant come before or after the clackers? Or, you know, I have in my room, I thought this was interesting, the room I'm staying in now, there's two copies of one book. So I thought, maybe this is a sign. There's two copies of that Jack Kornfield book called After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. You know that book? Because there were two copies, I picked one up, started looking through, but I thought, just in the title, this very nicely demonstrates these verses that we're talking about, right? The merging of ecstasy and laundry is the title, we could say. But also, you know, according with ecstasy is not the whole story, we still have to do the laundry. I think that's what the book seems to be about, is that after this experience of re, we still have to integrate G. We still have to, so the Huayan culmination of practice is, you know, phenomena, non-obstructing, like this shirt and these pants on the line, on the clothesline, are not obstructing each other. Laundry isn't a problem.
So an enlightened being has a self?
In a way, it depends what we mean by self, but if we could say...
Can you distinguish itself from others?
You could say there's, yeah, like a dependently co-arisen self. An enlightened being has a dependently arisen self, which is, or you could talk about it in many ways, it's like dependently co-arisen five skandhas is the self of a Buddha. But you could even say it's even more than just five skandhas. You could say there's even a dependently co-arisen sense of like, well, these five skandhas I call me, or Kokyo. I don't just call them five skandhas. But then the difference would be like, it's a mere designation. It's just a mere conventional designation that we say, well, this particular collection of karmic tendencies and body and mind stuff is I call me, but that's different from believing that there is this actually core independent me, like either that's the controller of the five skandhas, or that's the soul of the five skandhas, or the true essence of the five skandhas. It's like there's just this constantly changing body-mind experience. We could say five skandhas, or we could say these 12 sense fields of, there's just eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, color, sounds, so on. And we call that myself. So we just have to be careful how we use the words. You know, that's not self as like Atman, self. Atman is like this core, essential, unchanging essence of me-ness. We don't have to have that big problem. It's all self. Big self, we have, you know, say capital S self. And small self. This will be the subject of a detailed investigation in the next Santa Cruz Zen Center class, starting I think next week. Right? We're going to really look into what's the relationship of particularly the five skandhas, but just body mind experience to the self, and maybe all different, maybe more than just these two types of self, maybe all different types of what we call self. And there's some that are no problem at all and that we need to function. And there's some that are, in a way, just one particular one that they say traditionally is like the source of all suffering. It's this tiny little belief that there's something. But it's hard to distinguish between these different types and what that one is, and then how to work with that. And in a way, it's also not about getting rid of it. Sometimes people talk about we have to abolish the ego self or something. Well, it's impossible because there's nothing there to abolish. It's more just seeing it for as the illusion that it is, and then you can live with the illusion. But very fine line, I think, between like it's just an appearing sense. Sometimes I like to think of it as the seventh sense. We have these six senses. The seventh sense is the sense of me, the sense of a self. But if it's just a sense, and we know that it's just a sense that doesn't have a foundation, then that's okay. But we seem to believe, and this is the kind of radical thing that the tradition says, it's not like a rational kind of belief that we've come to believe through our upbringing and society. This is like an innate belief. Now, we might argue with this, but seems to be the Mahayana tradition, is that we're born with this like false, maybe belief could be misleading, like it's a view, it's a false view that we're through, again, past karma and past lives, if we go for that story, but it's what that tiny little belief is what just keeps the whole samsara wheel rolling along very well. Yeah, so there are cases where children don't develop a healthy sense of a self, and then there's problems with that too. So I think as Buddhism mixes with modern psychology, it seems most people agree now that we have to see through this this view or this kind of false belief that there's in this independent essence of me, but we can't even do that. We can't even start to work with that until we have like a good strong sense of me. Kind of like if it doesn't develop on its own, we might think, isn't that great if it doesn't develop? But no, I think it has to. So maybe parents might mourn when they start seeing their kids learn mine, you know, like really early on, like, oh, they were in this blissful Buddha state for like the first few months, and now they're becoming like a deluded human like me. And and but I think they have to, I think it's good. They have to get really into mine, me and mine, and then grow up, and then hopefully find the Dharma teachings that we may need to survive as a species. Actually, we may need to let go of that belief.
To success.
Yeah. Because we're, in a way, we're destroying ourselves through this belief. And whether it will, whether the dependent co-arising of this evolution will come into alignment, to kind of free ourselves before we extinguish ourselves, remains to be seen. We don't know, and I think we're not really in control. It's too vast. But in a way, we do a little part by having the sesshin.
Right. Yeah, it's
a purpose. It does. I think it's very true that you can see from a kind of evolutionary, kind of biological point of view, you can easily see all the reasons for this belief, this view to have developed actually for self-preservation and so on. And we maybe did need to, we needed it to get to this point, but the beauty is it seems like we don't need it to survive, actually. And we have examples like the Buddha did this experimental thing of like, let's see if I completely end this view, like, so it doesn't even arise anymore. This view is like completely seen through and dropped off. He seemed to like, didn't just die on the spot. In fact, his life seemed to go very well after that point. So it's good proof, but we're like, you know, it's hard because we have so many examples of other experiments, you know.
And the familiar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's so deep. This little tiny. It's not really, it doesn't have a size, but this very very subtle belief. They say, you know, part of the work of that I hope to explore in this class is first like identifying it, getting a sense for the actual belief, you know, kind of almost triggering it by certain, you know, it gets triggered all the time, right? But like in a kind of meditative setting, we can kind of like contemplate certain things that kind of like bring up the view, and it's a body-mind kind of experience. And in order to get it like in sight, to work with it, but it's very, very hard to get it in view because it's so elusive. It kind of pops up over here, and okay, here we are. But then it's over here now. Like, okay, like now it's over here, and it does that because it doesn't want to get caught. I think it really this view. It's kind of a funny way to talk about a view. It's very, very fast, very skillful, and very elusive, and. It's like, it's just a karmic thing, right? But it's like, its job is self-preservation for the whole organism, but maybe its main thing is self-preservation for itself. Like, the view wants to preserve itself. That's its main job, like, at all costs. If you get a good look at me, this will be very, very dangerous. So I'm going to keep, as soon as you start to look at me and focus, I'm going to move over here. But yeah, I am here, and don't you forget it. You could say that little voice is like Buddha nature, like knocking on your door of mind, like, you don't have to do this.
It's
like,
the other one's a bully,
but I think we could still say it's that loud voice of like, come on, keep grasping, is like, the view that it's based on, if we try to kind of like trace it back to that view, that's the one that's really quiet.
Like the Wizard of Oz, it's really just this little teeny black
screen.
It's big.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, yeah. The manifestation is a big hoo-ha, and the one behind the stage is just an ordinary little misconception. But our deepest misconception.
It tends to broaden a little bit.
And it's kind of scary, actually.
It's right? I don't know, yeah.
The more we're really open to I don't know, yeah, the more it's like, but what if I really, like, stop knowing or going along with what I think I have to do or whatever, I might die or just at least completely fall apart.
Kathy's shouting ruts.
Yeah, because, like, the habits kind of, like, they're a very comfortable reinforcement of the sense of the self. Even though they're unpleasant, I think that's, people say, well, why do we keep doing this if we know we don't really, like, we don't really believe it, at least on a conceptual level, but why do we keep reinforcing? I think because in a way there's this kind of comfort in the familiar. It's the familiar, you know, it's not very pleasant, but at least it's familiar. Where it's a really, I don't know, and like this, you know, Buddha that might do anything. That sounds great, but actually it's frightening because what if like my whole life falls apart? Yeah, we don't hear the follow-up stories about, you know. Then, you know, later that day, he was late to a meal or something, right? And then they scolded him and he got angry or, you know. Oh, whoops. And you know, just looking through this book after The Ecstasy, The Laundry, because there were two copies. In my room, there's all these stories about this. People's personal accounts of, like, they have this great opening and everything's just bliss. And then it never lasts. Yeah, and it's like, but then it's like the integration. And I think that's this G and Re thing, and YN is all about, you know, it starts, I think the first of these four, I think they're kind of progressive is how they present it. I think the first, I forget if it's principle. Dharma. Yeah, the Dharma Dhatus. I forget if it's principle or phenomena, but it might even be principle first. And then there's the phenomena, and then there's the integration. And at the very end, it's just about phenomena and phenomena completely harmoniously working. Like, forget all about emptiness, and but informed by emptiness, informed by knowing that things are not as they seem, then we'll work in the seeming world in a seamless way.
Opportunity, you know, which is not how we perceive it.
Yeah. Exactly. May we see every moment as like total opportunity, whether we're everything's just changing and freed up, or whether we seem totally stuck, equally.
We didn't have any of those things that hold us.
Yeah. Yeah. Could you see it? Could you see it as an opportunity?
It didn't when she mentioned? Feel like an opportunity. Yeah. I mean, I could see her point. But it doesn't feel that way.
Yeah, that's one of those things where this little voice can say, "Yeah, just what if I did see it that way?" Oh, yeah. That little turning voice. In a way, it lasts one moment, right? And another way, it pervades the universe, like Dogen says, like a hammer striking emptiness. Its exquisite peal permeates everywhere throughout space and time. Yeah, Buddha's awakening is like manifesting right now as all of us in this inconceivable way. And then how much can we like appreciate it? Shall we have some kinyin? Dedicate any merit arising from this discussion to the complete integration of principle and phenomena for all living beings.